Did you know we have completely ad-free early access to all of our episodes? Well, we do. Not only that, but we have dozens of bonus episodes waiting for you. Head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod, and you can check it out for 7 days absolutely free. That's patreon.com/ghosttownpod. A Walk to Remember. I'm Jason Horton.
I'm Rebecca Lieb.
And this is Ghost Town.
The mid-1850s was a tumultuous time in American history. Conflict over slavery was intensifying, leading to what would become the Civil War. Meanwhile, settlers were rapidly accelerating westward in a historic expansion that would also shape the course of history itself. But amongst the tension, the movement, the ambiguity, the emotion was a man clad in 60 pounds of thick leather, tanned himself by the sun and walking. Always walking between New York City and Hartford. As a piece in the New York Times would later say, quote, "The word strange hardly captures his strangeness. He was rough and hairy, and he wandered around on back roads, sleeping in caves. Above all, he refused to explain himself. Where did he come from? Where was he going? Nobody knew, but many would hypothesize about a controversial, unknown man turned legend, turned larger-than-life urban myth. Today on Ghost Town, let me introduce you to the Connecticut Leatherman. Though the Connecticut Leatherman was known for many things that we'll get into very soon, what struck me first was his route. The 365-mile loop he would make every 5 weeks for over 30 years. From 1857 to 1889, the Connecticut Leatherman would take the same iconic circuit through the northeastern United States. It was a 34-day-long clockwise trip through southwestern Connecticut and adjacent sections of lower New York State. The trips took him through Danbury, New Fairfield, Watertown, Middletown, and New Canaan into Westchester, New York, back to Danbury, and again to New Fairfield. He stopped for nothing and walked summer through winter in every possible type of weather. Though the seasons would change on the Leatherman's route between the Connecticut River and the Hudson River, his attire during all of it did not. As you might have guessed, the Connecticut Leatherman wore leather from head to toe. And whatever you're imagining the Connecticut Leatherman to look like, I promise you it is wrong. The Leatherman wore rough leather patches stitched together with long leather strips from his neck to his feet, like a thick, stinky quilt. His outfit was stiff, awkward, aromatic, and brutally heavy. Think wearing a sleeping bag made of baseball gloves and then walking all day, every day in it. He also wore a hat, a scarf, and shoes, all made of vinyl. No, just kidding. Of course it's leather. All leather. In fact, when people would give him scraps of leather on his route, he'd have to incorporate it into what he was wearing. To anyone in the mid-1800s encountering the Leatherman in their day-to-day, or anyone of any time, I would imagine, he must have seemed almost unreal, mythical even. A massive dark brown form creaking and squeaking and sloshing in his own sweat with every step, slowly making his way down a quiet country road. Nobody knew him. Nobody knew why he took his 300-plus mile route, and especially why he wore what he wore. He was effectively a mystery and a weird one at that, and one who I can't imagine in any world would be comfortable. Which added to the mystery. How could he endure this? He did this to himself. The Leatherman was his own leather man, bound in his own leather shackles. In the years following the Civil War, the leather-bound vagabond became an object, of course, of curiosity, and then a frequent subject of local newspapers. Quote, "I suppose that many of the readers of your valuable paper have heard of the old Leatherman," wrote someone from Rye, New York, in 1870. Quote, "Hearing the reports about his singular recluse, I, in company with others, paid his haunts a visit. It was in the press that the fire of inquiry was fueled, and also that this individual was given his enduring name, the Leatherman, Old Leatherman, or the Connecticut Leatherman." An early article in the Burlington Free Press dated April 7, 1870, also referred to him as the leather-clad man. Whatever his name, whatever you want to call him, the newspapers were eager to share what they knew about him. Namely, his 365-mile loop repeated about every 5 weeks or so, that he slept in curious caves and rock shelters, and popped into towns for food and supplies as needed. The newspapers didn't have much to go off of. The Connecticut Leatherman spoke rarely, but when he did say something, it would be simple, often monosyllabic, in grunts and gestures, in English and in French. This made people speculate that he was from France, and the Connecticut rumor mill thought perhaps Picardy, a city in northern France. When asked about his background, he would abruptly end the conversation. Another mystery, nobody knows how the Connecticut Leatherman earned his money, the money he spent when he'd stop by local grocery stores to get supplies. He was a simple man, one who enjoyed a nice little treat and perhaps a little buzz, as one store record reflects. On that visit, the Leatherman bought, quote, one loaf of bread, a can of sardines, 1 pound of fancy crackers, a pie, 2 quarts of coffee, 1 gill of brandy, and a bottle of beer. I wholeheartedly approve. When the Connecticut Leatherman wasn't placing fun grocery orders, he was hosted by curious townspeople. Everyone in Connecticut, now knowing his rounds after, say, a decade or two, knew exactly the pathway that he took. People would have food ready for him, which he often ate on their doorsteps. He would not accept shelter or money, but gladly took tobacco and leather scraps, of course, when offered. 10 towns along the Leatherman's route passed ordinances exempting him from the Connecticut State Tramp Law that was passed in 1879, a law that criminalized vagrancy in a post-Civil War America. The Leatherman truly became a beloved fixture in the Northeast. As the years passed, though, the Connecticut Leatherman went from colorful character to full-blown media phenomenon. The Hartford Globe published a front-page article complete with a timetable of his travels. In small towns, people would line up to watch him pass, knowing, of course, that he was coming. It was like how people would watch, say, a marathon, if that marathon was one man limping around in a thick leather tuxedo. School teachers let their best student go outside to give the Leatherman food when he passed on, quote, Leatherman Day. And many, eager to capitalize on this strange man, offered postcards, photos, woodcuts, and paintings timed to his circuit. But while the Connecticut Leatherman enjoyed generosity, tobacco, and anything to add to his leather obsession, he was not interested in the limelight. In fact, he went out of his way to avoid it. The Leatherman steered clear of the region's biggest cities, Hartford, Bridgeport, New Haven, and if someone asked too many questions, he'd walk away from them and never interact with them again. Once in Woodbury, Connecticut, someone presented the old Leatherman with some recent articles about him. Quote, he grunted over them, the newspaper account read, but showed no enthusiasm at finding himself famous. This, of course, made people speculate even more. People wondered about his French accent, thinking he might be French or French-Canadian or Portuguese. Some thought he came from a family in Hartford named Brown, and the whole Frenchman on the brink of leather-clad insanity was all a ruse. He declined meat on Fridays, giving rise to speculation that he was Roman Catholic. Others said he was immune to rattlesnake bites. The old Leatherman, another claimed, was disguising himself to evade police. He was a fugitive, or a wealthy businessman, brought low by a fire, mourning the death of his fiancée. The more he walked, the more people talked. Like I said before, the invitations the Connecticut Leatherman received to sleep in people's houses and barns were offered but never accepted. He preferred to sleep in caves and hollows. At a certain point, however, curious Connecticutians found his hideaways, a few of which are still named after him. There, these onlookers got a whole new dimension of the mysterious Connecticut Leatherman. The caves he dwelt in were marvels within themselves, orderly, complete with primitive fireplaces, sleeping areas, and stores of food, like meat and hickory nuts. Under one slab of rock, he had dug out a whole apple cellar. In some of his forested nooks, he kept well-tended gardens. The Leatherman had not only cultivated a persona, but an inner life and resources all his own. That is, until 1888, when the Leatherman would make the transition from actual man to folk hero. More after this break. Okay. If you've listened this far, I need you to wish our own favorite Leatherman, just kidding, he's very young and hot and sexy, Jason Horton, a happy birthday. This episode comes out on his birthday. He has a giant stand-up show, and I know he would love if you reached out to support, rate, review, anything you feel comfortable helping with. We'll take. We need it. Clearly, we'll take it. Happy birthday, Jason. We've been doing this a long time, and I appreciate everything you do and everyone else does too, right? Right, everybody? Right. Well, okay. That being said, let's get back to the Leatherman, shall we? Okay, if we must. Despite being spared from the punishing vagabond laws of the time, ones that perpetuated widespread public panic about dangerous quote-unquote tramps, the Leatherman carried on. One noteworthy and mysterious story about him, as told by writer Sam Anderson, who walked the Leatherman's loop in 2024 and wrote about it for the New York Times, he said that his favorite incident in the old Leatherman cadre of stories happened in a small town called Shrub Oak, where many Leatherman fans lived and helped him when he reached that point in the loop. One family, called the Ireland's, kept a special bowl and spoon just to feed the Leatherman. Down the street, at Darrow's grocery store, the owner kept notes in his account book about the Connecticut Leatherman's trips through town. In February 1885, when the old Leatherman didn't show up on schedule, people worried. The weather had been terrible, rainy, and freezing. A group from the town, concerned, went to check on the nearest cave, which was in the woods near the ruins of a sawmill. But on February 19th, the Connecticut Leatherman finally made his appearance. He was several days late and seemed to be in a hurry, trying to make up for lost time. Darrow the grocer motioned for him to come inside, and, despite never coming inside or accepting any indoor invitations, he did. He sat down next to Darrow's fire, and Darrow gave him some cheese and crackers and watched the old Leatherman eat. At that point, he decided to try something. Darrow took out a pencil and a piece of paper. "I am old," Darrow said, and he wrote down his age. Then he passed the paper and pencil to the Connecticut Leatherman. "How old are you?" Darrow asked. People had been trying to get this information forever, and today, somehow, the generosity, the cold, maybe it was just the right point in time, the Connecticut Leatherman responded. In large, crooked strokes, he wrote a string of numbers. 1, 5, 3, 4, 2. A few days later, a local newspaper printed the Leatherman's answer, and of course, all of the theories around it. There were debates about it. Some thought the Leatherman must have been writing his birthday in European style, like 15-3-42 or March 15th, 1842. This would have made him 42 years old. Some took it at face value as evidence that he was some kind of mythical creature, 15,342 years old. Decades later, the researcher Allison Albee offered this speculation, quote, "One guess being as good as another, perhaps the Leatherman, understanding neither the question nor the meaning of Mr. Darrow's figures, showed his own peculiar method of writing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Or maybe it was some kind of code. I don't know. We'll never know. The Connecticut Leatherman's last loop came in March of 1889. For months, it had been made clear that something was really wrong with him. You can see it in photos of the time. He seems sick. There are sores around his mouth. When the Connecticut Leatherman ate, he covered the sore with a special patch of course, leather. One house he stopped at for breakfast belonged to a doctor, and the Leatherman allowed him to examine his lip. The doctor gave him some ointment, and he was on his way. Eventually, this sore ate away half of the Leatherman's jaw. At this point, he could hardly eat. He had to soak his food in coffee, then drink it, and some of it would come pouring right through his own face. His walking, of course, got slower, but he kept going. Finally, according to Anderson, people along his loop decided to try something drastic to help him. When the Connecticut Leatherman stopped for a meal, as he always did, at the house of Amy Guy in Middleton, Connecticut, she sent a messenger 2 miles up the road to his next stop, the Fisher House. When the Leatherman showed up there, he encountered a group of strangers, the police chief, the town physician, representatives of the Connecticut Humane Society. They, quote, arrested him benevolently and put him into a carriage to take him to the hospital. According to one of the Fishers, quote, he went with no reluctance and seemed to understand why, though the conversation was carried on by signs mostly. The Connecticut Leatherman stayed at Hartford Hospital, but not for long. He was found to be sane, but with a, quote, severe emotional affliction. As he was deemed sane, he had his own money, it was, again, never determined how, and that he clearly expressed he wanted freedom, the hospital had to let him go. On March 24th, 1889, approximately a year later, the body of the Leatherman was found in one of his caves near Mount Pleasant, New York. An autopsy revealed that he had died from mouth cancer, likely from his tobacco use. Oddly enough, and despite his hardened traveling lifestyle, he was found in remarkably good condition. While his face was frostbitten, he had not lost any fingers. In his possessions was a French prayer book, an awl, scissors, an axe, and an extra axe head. His leather outfit was weighed after his death. It weighed exactly 60 pounds. According to historian David Hoberman, locals buried his remains in the pauper section of Sparta's cemetery in nearby Ossining, New York. The original tombstone read, "Final resting place of Jules Bourgelais of Lyon, France, the Leather Man, who regularly walked a 365-mile route through Westchester and Connecticut from the Connecticut River to the Hudson, living in caves in the years 1858 to 1889. So was the Connecticut Leatherman Jules Bourgelais? And who the hell was Jules Bourgelais? And why did he choose to lead this unconventional life? Now, dead people labeled the Leatherman as such, perhaps to give themselves the closure they needed about his active yet solitary life. The best-known theory, and one that circulated in the press during his death and much of his lifetime, was that the Leatherman was in fact Jules Bourgelais. Who was Bourgelais? Well, he was the disgraced suitor of the daughter of one of France's foremost leather speculators. Having inadvertently brought about the financial ruin of his fiancée's family, Bourgelais fled France, mysteriously surfaced in Connecticut, his first recorded appearance occurred in Harwinton in 1858, and walked to ease the guilt, clad in leather shackles. Romantic, right? And kind of convenient in that Bourgelais did live in Connecticut and was seen. But according to historians, it's not quite right. According to researchers, including Dan W. DeLuca, who wrote a book about the Leatherman, and the Leatherman's own New York death certificate, the identity of the Leatherman still to this day remains unknown. On May 25th, 2011, DeLuca and the town's historical society were able to get a new headstone installed when the Leatherman's grave was moved in the Sparta graveyard away from the busy Route 9 to a more private corner. But more importantly than the movement, to be somewhere quieter, was when the grave was moved, the Leatherman's gravesite was actually exhumed. Researchers hoped the exhumation might provide clues about the Leatherman's identity. Unfortunately, no human remains were recovered during the exhumation. Only coffin nails and soil from the original burial plot remained. Nicholas Bellatoni, a University of Connecticut archaeologist and supervisor of the exhumation, cited that time, the effect of traffic over the shallow original gravesite, and possible removal of graveside material by a road grading project likely destroyed all hard and soft tissue in the grave. But was the leather suit still there? I couldn't find anything that said it wasn't, so I'm saying yes. After the grave was moved and situated, a simple stone marker was put up to commemorate it, a much different one than the one before. In keeping with the mystery, it to this day reads simply, The Leatherman. Of course, people still talk about the Leatherman, a figure firmly entrenched in East Coast culture. The Leatherman was a subject of a 1984 documentary, and his caves are still called Leathermen to locals. The Connecticut Leatherman even inspired a song by the American rock band Pearl Jam called, of course, Leatherman. But one of the most powerful legacies of the Connecticut Leatherman is his loop, a loop many choose to walk to feel closer to American history. Writer Sam Anderson, who shared some great anecdotes we've used in this episode, walked the trail in 2024, and like I've cited, wrote about it for the New York Times. He relates the experience of the walk as bringing old and new together, exploring oppositions, dichotomies, a symbol of how a human can exist on multiple planes in a world so unaccepting as post-Civil War America. Says Anderson, quote, "The townspeople regarded the Leatherman with a mix of closeness and distance, familiarity and alienation. He was the insider's outsider. He didn't belong, but he was accepted. Wherever he went, he created a circle of civility. His loop tied together otherwise disparate communities like beads on a string. The tramp laws, curiously, didn't seem to apply to him. By tramping so openly, he seemed to transcend the category. He was in his own special category. He was the old Leatherman."